Good morning, everyone. It's 11:30. It's time for us to get started on Constitutional Rights, Rule of Law, and Government Operations Subcommittee. As you can see, our chair is not here right now, so I'm going to go ahead and get started. I'll remind everybody to please silence their electronic devices, and we will do the roll call. Tamara, please call the roll.
Chair Roach, Vice Chair Roth.
Here.
Democratic Ranking Member Joseph.
Here.
Representative Bankson.
Here.
Brackett.
Here.
Brannon, excuse. Cross. Edmonds, excuse. Jacques.
Here.
Lopez J.
Here.
Plakin, excuse. Porras. Here. Trunell.
Here.
Waldron.
Here.
Yarkowski. A quorum is present.
Thank you. Again, I'll mention the electronic devices. I do get the opportunity to make some open remarks. I'm disappointed that Representative Chair Roach is not here, which means I have to actually do some work. and the other thing that's a little bit disconcerting is these are so many good bills we're hearing today, and me being the chair, I don't get to lead off with the questions. So let's get started. Just for the record, H.R. 1261 by Shoaf has been temporarily postponed for members that were interested in that. And so we're going to start with PCS for HB 718 by Clemens, unsolicited proposals for public-private partnerships. Oh, 781, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr.
The typo. I did see the typo about 11 o'clock last night. Yes, sir, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm dyslexic myself sometimes, so I understand completely. PCS for HB 781 is regarding unsolicited proposals for public-private partnerships. This bill will increase, or hopefully be a tool to increase, public-private partnerships at the local time when Florida's infrastructure is in serious need of these types of partnerships. As you know, we have a new city of Orlando moving to Florida each and every day. Some of these major infrastructure projects are 10, 15, and 20 years out into the future. So funding them and getting them on the list, sometimes the appreciation or the inflation between the time it's a project and the time it's implemented makes the project cost twice as much. This legislation addresses an issue with the public notice requirements in the current law, which are required unsolicited bids for public-private partnerships to be publicly noticed. This requirement discourages the submission of unsolicited PPP proposals, that's public-private partnership proposals, because private entities who submit unsolicited project plans for projects often get undercut by other bidders. In other words, if, I'm giving you an example, Mr. Chairman, if I come up with an idea and I bring it to the local body, the city or the county commission, as an unsolicited proposal, all of my work comes out front and the listing of what I would charge to do that. So anyone else that would come in after me already knows how much work that is and how much that costs. So it puts me, as the original idea person, undercut by others. HB 781 will increase the public-private partnership opportunities. And I say opportunities, no city commission, no county commission, no authority is required to do this. It's just another tool in the toolkit for critical infrastructure projects to get them moved along. There are guardrails in this bill, and I want to emphasize those guardrails. Public entities must hold two public hearings to receive input from not only the citizens, but for any affected parties. Not one, but two. Public entities must publish a report that provides for the public interest determination and specifically detailed information in the Florida Administrative Register for 7 days. The public interest determination report must consider these six things. Benefits to the public. They need to articulate why this is a beneficial project to the public. The financial structure of the proposals and the economic efficiencies. The private entity's qualifications, experience, and the ability. Does this person who brought this idea have the capacity to actually complete this project. And then the project's compatibility with the regional infrastructure plans, the statement of reasons, the proposal should proceed based upon any and all public comments that they might receive. That's the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Speaker Pro Tem, for that good explanation of the bill. Members, we are in questions. We have questions. Representative Cross, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Clemens, I'm wondering if you think that an unintended consequence of this may be reduced competition in the private sector if we're going the route of public meetings rather than opening it up for the bidding process.
You recognize.
Mr. Chair, that's a great question, Representative Cross. I would understand completely why anyone looking at this bill, you know, off the cuff would think that. I might have thought that maybe too at one time, and the more I dug down into it, what I actually found was, no, it won't decrease competition, it would increase competition, and here's why. The good ideas that are spawned from these unsolicited proposals are not rewarded. In other words, if I invent the new mousetrap and I take it to the county commission, you know, Hillsborough County Commission, and I say I can invent this new mousetrap for X number of dollars, and that's a good idea, and then all of a sudden, all of my work, all of my research, all of my the time and effort I've put into this, and even what I'm going to charge the commission to do this, is now labeled out in public. So that's kind of an unfair advantage. See, this is just a tool. It doesn't require the county commissions to use this tool. In other words, they can still require the open bidding process. They can still do everything that the way that they did it before. And if Mr. Chair, if you allow, I'll give you an example, because I had to look at the examples myself. In Manatee County, close to where you live, the Fort Hammer Bridge, have you ever been across it? Okay. The Fort Hammer Bridge project started in 2015, and it was a two-year project commissioned by the county commission, at the urging of community folks who wanted more accessible route to Parrish, which was named after one of my relatives, Parrish, and Lakewood Ranch, if you're familiar. It was completed 2 years later at a cost of $32 million as compared to the original county commission estimate of $92 million. So the Fort Hammer Bridge is a 2,300-foot bridge that spans the Manatee River. I'm just giving you an example. That's the type of creativity that saved, in that case, $70 million for the local taxpayers to create a bridge that would not have normally been there and would still be on the drawing board today, if you follow me. So it's not an answer to all the problems. This legislation is just one more tool that city commissions and county commissions can have to maybe expedite if it's feasible and it's economical for those bodies and the taxpayers to do that. It's a win-win. Can be.
You're okay? Follow up? Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a different question. I didn't see anything about the requirements of where a municipality would need to notice these public meetings. Is that something that is contemplated in the bill?
Recognize.
Mr. Chairman? I would believe that there's no exceptions or changes to where those things would be noticed. I know it has to be into the circular, but that's part of the business anyway. The normal, unless you guys can tell me otherwise, I think the normal advertising for public, and you have to have two, not one, but two public meetings.
That's correct.
And they have to meet whatever the public meeting requirements are that we have outside of this legislation.
Yes, sir, Chair. Yes, sir, that's correct. Any other questions, members? Any other questions, members? Ranking member Joseph, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know we spoke about this a little bit last night, this morning, and I wanted just to make sure it's clear on the record because some people reached out about any limitations on public input in this process. And there's a difference between the public notice requirement versus the public input requirement. Would you care to explain that a little bit more for the record?
Mr. Yes, Chairman, and thank you, Representative Joseph, for bringing this, because public input is imperative at every step of any plan to solve and resolve the problems, especially when you're using taxpayer money. The way I understand it, and yes, And by the time you texted last night, I go to bed early. So I'm sorry. Thank you for letting me respond to you this morning. The public input would come at the scheduled public hearings, and there was required, according to this legislation, two public hearings to not only have from the public, but any other affected parties. So other companies, that would be an opportunity for other companies to say, wait, we could do this job too, and we could do it and save even more money. Well, that's the place, Representative Joseph, where they would put their case forward to the city commission or the county commission or whatever the governing board that is administratively in charge of that project. And so their case would be made in the public forum right there, but they wouldn't necessarily know how much the original idea submitter was going to charge for that. Does that make sense?
Follow up? Okay. Any other questions, members? Seeing no amendments, we do have public testimony. First one is Christopher Strandberg, Americans for Prosperity. Wave in support. Thank you. We have Gary Hunter with Neal Communities. Wave in support. All right, that takes care of the public testimony. Members, we are now in debate. Members, we are now in debate. Representative Waldron, you're recognized.
I'll be very brief since I know we have a lot on the plate, but I just want to say thank you for this bill because I have been on the wrong end of this with this unsolicited proposal for P3. So I think this is a really great bill, and I'm really happy. So thank you very much.
Members, any other debate? Okay, sir, you're recognized to close.
Mr. Chairman, sometimes to meet the needs of the state of Florida, how fast we're growing will require us to stretch our boundaries and maybe look at solving and resolving problems in a different way than we have in the past, just because we've always done it that way. This is not a requirement for the local governments or the local entities to change the way that they're operating as far as their bid process. What it will do, if this is passed, is provide another opportunity to solve and resolve their problems, and in the case of the Fort Hammer Bridge, at a significant reduction in cost to the taxpayers over the original estimate. And that is my hope if this bill passes. So I urge your support for this. It has gone through one Senate committee, and it was unanimous in that committee. So it's scheduled next week for the second committee. Thank you for the consideration.
Thank you for that close. Tamara, please call the roll.
Representative Bankson?
Yes.
Brackett?
Yes.
Cross?
Yes.
Shock?
Yes.
Joseph?
Yes.
Lopez?
Yes.
Porras?
Yes.
Roth?
Yes.
Trunell? Waldron?
Yes.
Rakowski? Yes. And Chair Roach. 11 yeas, 0 nays.
Thank you, members. By your vote, House Bill 781 is reported favorably. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Speaker
Chairman.
Pro Temp. Next up, we have HB 229. Chair Payne, you are ready for Public Service Commission rules. HB 229, you're recognized, sir.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, Chair and members. It's good to see you in this role. I know you're doing a great job back there, Chair Roth. Members, HB 229 is Public Service Commission rules. So let me give you a little background on the rule. The Public Service Commission, or PSC, as most of you are aware, is an arm of the legislature and is charged with regulating the rates and services of electric, natural gas, water, and wastewater investor-owned utilities. It's also has some regulatory oversight over certain telecommunications service activities. The commission is a trust fund agency, receiving funds from utilities each year in the form of regulatory assessment fees, levied by rule by the commission. The legislature requires such users' fees to cover the cost of regulation. The commission receives no general revenue funding. In 2023, the legislature granted language in the implementing bill, SB 2502, which exempts the Public Service Commission regulatory assessment fee rules from legislative ratification for 1 year. Excuse me. HB 229 makes permanent exemption for the PSC for the RAFE rule from that ratification. And so under this bill, the PSC will continue to provide statements of estimated regulatory cost. Passage of the bill will enable the commission to once again prudently manage the revenue streams. And that is the bill, Chair.
Thank you, Chair, for that good explanation. Members, we are in questions. Questions on the bill. Seeing no questions, I, sir, would like to ask a question. Not really knowing how the procedures of the Public Service Commission really work, I have a question. The last part of the explanation of the bill is you're talking about exempting certain rules to implement certain chapters of law. And, you know, you just wonder if that sounds like you're giving additional leeway or flexibility where it's not normally allowed. So could you please explain why we're giving these exemptions?
Sure. Yeah. Yes, Chair, thank you. In 2010, the legislature adopted legislative ratification of all proposed rule agency rules. And for anything that exceeds $1 million in regulatory cost impacts within 5-year period of implementing. Because of the size of the industry, the regulation by PSC and any meaningful increases in the rate will trigger ratification. The legislative ratification process, as applied by the PSC, also prevents some agencies from complying with statutory obligations or mandates, mandates that can trust for those fund revenues. So if the commission were to adopt regulatory assessment fees by rule, then legislation ratification of these rules and rules were ratified by the legislature, they would not be able to fulfill their statutory obligations. So what happens is the timing of trying to keep a balance of their fund in the ratification rule is often a lengthy and incomplete process. So by the time you get it ratified, it could be 3 years, their trust fund balance falls below a statutory requirement.
So you would say that this basically is really going to efficiency and allowing the PSC to do its job.
Agreed. And ratification for other agencies has been granted. The exemption for ratification has been exempted in the past by the legislature.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
Any other questions? Representative Cross, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Payne, would this have any impact on the ability for the public to weigh in on proposed increases to their utility rates?
You're recognized.
Thank you for the question. Thank you, Chair. No, it wouldn't. They would still have the opportunity to weigh in through the PSC on these rates. There's always the process. There's several steps to the process before they establish rates, so it would not affect that.
Follow up? Any other questions, members? Any other questions? Okay, we do not have any amendments, so we're on to public testimony. We have Keith Hetrick, Public Service Commission General Counsel. What I would expect. We have Lance Watson, also of the Public Service Commission. Again, I would expect. And that's all we have for public testimony. So, members, we are now in debate. Members, we are now in debate. Seeing no debate, Chair, you're recognized to close.
Thank you, Chair. Members, I would just mention that this bill passed out of the Senate this morning 40-0. So with that, I'll close. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair, for that explanation. And Tamara, please call for the vote.
Representatives Bankson?
Yes.
Brackett?
Yes.
Cross?
Yes.
Shock?
Yes.
Joseph?
Yes.
Lopez?
Yes.
Porras?
Yes.
Roth?
Yes.
Trunell? Waldron?
Yes.
Yarkowski?
Yes.
Chair Roach. 11 yeas, 0 nays.
Thank you, members. By your vote, HB 229 is reported 229 is reported favorably. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members.
Okay, we're on to HB 1679, Florida African American Heritage Preservation Network. Chair McClure and Representative Rayner, you're recognized to present your bill.
Thank you, Chairman. I'm going to have my good
good friend and ranking member on State Affairs. Representative Rayner, present the bill if that's all right with you.
Yes, sir.
Thank you so much, Chair McClure and Vice Chair and Ranking Member. So today we have a bill. This bill would require the Department of State to contract with the Florida African American Heritage Preservation Network and in a way that is consistent with the General Appropriations Act, and would allow the contract to be able to distribute funds, support museums, and provide professional resources. Just a brief little history about the Florida African American Heritage Preservation Network. It's a professional association that was organized in 2001 by the John Gilmore Reilly Center Museum. It serves as an informational and technical assistance resource in response to the growing interest in preserving Florida's deep and rich African American history and culture. And that is the bill.
Thank you for that explanation of the bill, Representative Rayner. And members, we are on questions. Members, do we have questions? I have a question. Imagine that.
Now, I would have expected that.
I'm having fun today, sir. Yep. So where are we at on the timeline? You're saying this is 2001. So have we made some progress? Are we at the beginning of the progress? Are we partway, halfway? Where we are in the process of creating more museums and doing more for African American history?
So I'm glad you asked that, Vice Chair. So right now, as you know, that there's a task force, I believe, that Representative Jock sits on and Representative Michael and Senator Thompson sits on, that is actually creating a state museum. However, this organization actually helps and supports the smaller chain of museums throughout the state. So we have a museum in St. Petersburg. We have one in Hillsborough County. We're actually, hopefully, if this bill should pass, would actually support the building of a new African American Arts and Cultural Center in Hillsborough County that would be able to house folks for amphitheaters, different concerts, those kinds of things. So we are making a lot of progress in preserving the rich history of African Americans here in Florida.
Thank you for that explanation. Representative Yarkowski, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for this bill. It's a great bill. And in my district in Groveland, we have uncovered an incredible relic of the African American cemeteries that we know we're finding around the state. And I've been involved in that, and it's been an honor and unbelievable stories. Does this bill have any effect on that work as well? Will it create any funding or any more recognition? I'm just curious how that might fit in with what you're doing here.
Yes. Oh, I'm sorry.
You're recognized.
Thank you so much. Yes, actually, if your museum in your district is a part of the preservation network, it would actually be able to, this bill would actually benefit that museum if it's a part of the preservation network. And so what I've been finding out from different member museums, that the preservation network does a lot to really just uplift and make sure that the stories are being told and making sure that our museums can grow.
Okay, we're good. Any other questions, members? Okay, we have no amendments, so we're on to public testimony. We have Barney Bishop with Guardians of American History, Incorporated. Waves in support. We also have Althemus Barnes, hope I got that right, with the FAAHPN. He's an officer, and he waves in support. Okay, we're done with public testimony, so now, members, we are in debate. Any members wishing to debate? Seeing no. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Cross. I shouldn't be surprised.
It's me again.
Yes, ma'am. You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to thank both of you for bringing this great bill forward.
Okay, with that, members, we're done with debate. So, Representative Rayner, you're recognized to close.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. I also did want to point out that Representative Antone, he is also on the task force as well. I did not see my good friend sitting behind me, and also commend him for his work also with this organization that has brought us here today. That's a little bit of Florida legislature history for you, but we would just appreciate your favorable support on this bill.
Thank you. With that, Tamara, are we ready for the vote?
Representatives Bankson?
Yes.
Brackett?
Yes.
Cross?
Yes.
Shock?
Yes.
Joseph?
Yes.
Lopez?
Yes.
Porras? Yes. Roth?
Yes.
Trunell?
Yes.
Waldron?
Yes.
Gorkowski?
Yes.
11 yeas, 0 nays.
Thank you, members. By your vote, we are this bill 1679 is reported favorably. And now we're moving on to HB 1013 by Representative Stevenson, State Board of Administration. Chair Stevenson, you are recognized.
Thank you, Chair Roth. House Bill 1013 would change statutes to allow the SBA to generate liquidity by securitizing alternative investments. This is very much like what a homeowner does when taking out a home equity loan on their residence. This would allow the SBA to rebalance their portfolio and generate liquidity. Rebalancing a portfolio is a very important part of the way they manage risk, and it's part of their duty as a fiduciary. They are required to diversify their investments, and in statute, there's actually guidelines for proportions of holdings. They do this by allocating targeted percentages of their portfolio to specific types of assets like equities, fixed income, or real estate. When the value of certain investment types cause them to exceed their target percentage, they would like to take the gains from those investments and redistribute them to other parts of their portfolio, which is easy to do with stocks and bonds, but not with venture capital and private equity funds, which we'll refer to as alternative investments. These investments aren't traded on exchanges like the New York Stock Exchange or NASDAQ. And in the past, SBA has sold positions in alternative investments to accomplish these goals. That can result in the funds foregoing future gains or even having to accept a discount on the value when there are few potential bidders. The market has evolved to allow for securitized loans as an alternative to the outright sale of alternative investments. In these situations, the SBA would issue securities or bonds and receive the proceeds from the purchaser. The purchaser of the security, the lender, would hold the right to income from the private equity investment as repayment and security for the bonds. The SBA would then retain ownership of the underlying investment. Essentially, this is like a part sale, while they would retain the upside potential on the repayment of the bond principal. The SBA intends to implement the program to be without recourse to the State Board of Administration or to the Florida Retirement Service Trust Fund. In this structure, the security for the bonds would be the income from the related alternative investment. The statute would limit the program to conservatively to 5% of the SBA's funds. This would allow them to avoid the need to sell into a distressed market or at discounted values. Pardon me. It should lower transaction cost as compared to an outright sale, and it would allow flexibility to generate liquidity, rebalance their portfolio, and maximize investment returns. And that's good for everyone in the state, because more returns, the less GR we have to put in those other funds. And that is the bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair, for that explanation. Members, we are at questions. Anybody have a question? Come on, folks. You don't want me to go first, do you? I am going to ask you a question, Chair. I really appreciate the people coming by from the State Board of Administration and giving me a full explanation of this bill. Obviously, as a business owner, I have to worry about my own company's investments for our pension fund. So the simple question is, I think you've answered most of what my concerns was in your explanation, that this is a very measured approach. It's only 5% maximum, that there are restrictions, but it is really a cost-saving move, but it also allows them to really be able to take advantage of opportunities. But for the simple person like us as members that are part of the FRS, is this exposing us to a little bit more risk? Because you kind of think of it as risk versus opportunity to make a return. Is this considered to be in any way, shape, or form a little bit of a risk?
I would say not. We do have members from the State Board of Administration that could come and speak to that. What I would say, because they would know the terms when they negotiate the sale, they're basically selling the income stream. They're making an investment decision, and so is the person who's buying it, that's good for them. And that by holding that and having another opportunity, it allows them to avoid being forced to sell an asset at the wrong moment. It should actually be beneficial. I don't know if, Mr., would you like to add to that or clarify if I've misstated?
Yes. Yes, sir, Mr. Taylor, you're recognized.
Thank you. I'm Lamar Taylor. I'm the Interim Executive Director and Chief Investment Officer of the State Board of Administration. In short, and I think the representative has done a fantastic job explaining this bill, and everything she said is spot on. We would look at this as a risk mitigation tool because it helps us rebalance our portfolio. It helps us move out of assets that are overweight by virtue of their value being greater than the percentage that we've allocated to those investments, and taking those gains and being able to shift those in other parts of the portfolio. It's a structured way for us to sell high and buy low. So we think it's a risk management tool, and so that's how we would look at it.
Thank you for that good explanation. I would like to ask you another question. Oh, you Representative Joseph. Okay, so obviously the simple thought that we as representatives always say is there precedent in other areas, other states, other pension funds that other people are already doing this? That's my question.
Yes, sir, there are. There are other large institutional investors, sovereign wealth funds, insurance companies. We understand there are two large U.S. pension plans that are looking at this as an option and an opportunity. So, yes, this has been done before.
Representative Joseph, you have a question?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Ranking member.
Thank you. So thank you for meeting with us earlier today. And I wanted to follow up to make sure I understood something. From when we spoke, I believe right now the fund balance has about 10% in real estate. And it's a mix of residential and commercial. And I think I had articulated my concern about affordableness of the units. And I recall that you said that it was market. Can you tell me about anything with respect to either the affordability with properties that you're building, like how you take that into account, in addition to any parameters you have with respect to existing units that you rent out?
You're recognized.
Thank you for the question. So I guess we would approach the affordability issue with, we're trying to add more supply. This is a good market, as particularly in multifamily residential. There is a housing shortage in this country. There's a housing shortage in the state of Florida. And we're doing what we can to add supply because it's going to be beneficial in terms from a return perspective to our beneficiaries. With respect to affordability, again, we everything we do is looked at from the lens of a fiduciary, and our objective is to maximize the investment returns for the pension fund, for our beneficiaries, for their retirement. And so our focus is, are we going to be paid for the risk we're taking? Are we generating the returns commensurate with the risk, commensurate with other investment opportunities? That's our primary focus, and we think that the affordability issue should work itself out over time as we add more supply to the market. And as other, I mean, it's not just us, as other institutional investors across the country trying to add to the supply.
Thank you. Members, any other questions? Mr. Taylor, you did fill out a comment card. So are there any other additional comments you want to make?
No, sir.
Okay. We're on to debate. Members, we have any debate? You're not obligated. Yeah, Ranking Member Joseph, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for bringing this bill. I think adding the flexibility is definitely a good thing for the fund, and being able to rebalance at optimal times in the market and timing would be good. So that being said, not directly related, but tied to the issues that we identified earlier, it would be wonderful if we could figure out a way to factor in affordability with respect to the residential units. Commercial is a whole different ballgame, but with respect to any residential properties that are held within the fund, not the subject of your bill, just putting this out there in the ether, to both maximize profits, but also factor in affordability, right? So it doesn't have to be at the top range of the profitability marker, but since it's government-owned property, I think it would be good to be able to take some of that into account.
Members, don't see any hands for debate, so Chair Stevens, you are recognized to close.
Thank you, Chair Roth, and I'll be just very brief. This is my observation from watching the SBA over a number of years in SATIS and in the other appropriations briefings on the performance of the pension fund. They've done a very good job in their management of investments and are sophisticated in that and have outperformed the market generally. So I appreciate the opportunity to bring this bill, and I ask for your support to add another tool in their toolbox so they can continue to optimize revenue for the people of the state of Florida, and that benefits not just these funds, but all the other funds we have available, including funds for affordable housing. And with that, I close.
Thank you for that close. Tamara, please call the vote.
Representative Spangson?
Yes.
Brackett?
Yes.
Cross?
Yes.
Shock?
Yes.
Joseph?
Yes.
Lopez?
Yes.
Horace?
Yes.
Roth?
Yes.
Trunell?
Yes.
Waldron?
Yes.
Yarkovsky?
Chair Roach. 10 yeas, 0 nays.
Thank you. Thank you, members. By that vote, HB 1013 will be reported favorably. Thank you. Great job, Chair Stevenson. Okay, now we're on to HB 1227 by Antone and Bankson, the Tuskegee Airmen Commemoration Day. And as a pilot, I'm really looking forward to this opportunity to hear what you have to say. You're recognized.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. I'm here today to present HB 1227, which would create the Tuskegee Airmen Commemoration Day, which would be the fourth Thursday of March each year. This would be a state designated holiday. It is not a state paid holiday. It is a state designated holiday. And there are, I believe, 22 state designated holidays here in the state of Florida. And so just to get to the kind of salient points of what this bill is all about and why we need Tuskegee Airmen Commemoration Day, I attended Tuskegee Institute, and Chief Alfred Anderson, who flew Eleanor Roosevelt on a flight. He was an instructor at Tuskegee, and he flew around, and that kind of gave support and lended support to the civilian pilot program, which became known as the Tuskegee Airmen Project. So about 1,000 pilots trained at Tuskegee, and some of those pilots eventually came down to Florida to train. So they did their advanced training here at Dale Mabry Field in Tallahassee, where there was about 8,000 soldiers over a period of time. And they also trained in Eglin. The Tuskegee Airmen flew 1,578 combat missions. They flew 179 bomber escort missions. And they were the first United States pilots to shoot down some German jets. So they shot down three German jets in one day. But again, 1,000 pilots trained. Tuskegee Airmen also includes the flight surgeon. So when this program came about, the first African-American flight surgeons were created, the first African-American flight nurses. Then you had the mechanics. So all of that was kind of considered the Tuskegee Airmen. So I'm going to stop there. These were some brave Negro and colored men. So back then, they were considered Negroes and colored. My birth certificate says Negroid for race. So they were brave Negroes and colored men. They were not black. They were not African-American. They were brave Negroes and colored men. And so also part of the Tuskegee Airmen was some Haitian pilots. There were some French pilots. And then there were some others from South America. So I'm going to stop there.
Thank you, Representative, for that great opening. Members, we are in questions. Any members have a question? Come on, you don't want me to go first, do you? Come on. So I do have a question for Representative Antone.
Uh-huh.
When we think of breaking the race barrier, we think of heroes like Jackie Robinson. Mm-hmm. If you come to my office, you actually have a portrait on the wall of Jackie Robinson stealing home plate. And that's pretty amazing. Mm-hmm. Is there anything you want to say about the Tuskegee Airmen in terms of breaking any barriers? Is there something we should know about the Tuskegee Airmen? Maybe you've already stated it, but I wanted to hear you say it again.
I have not. So this program was created around 1940, 1941. Again, these were the first colored and Negro men to be able to fly in the military. They were brave men. They were patriotic men. They were men willing to die for their country at a time where Jim Crow laws were enforced and when the military was racially segregated at the same time my dad served. So I hope I'm answering your question.
You are. Thank you.
Okay.
Sir. Any other questions, members? Seeing no other questions, we have public testimony. We have the Barney Bishop with the Guardians of American History waving in support. We also have Karen Murillo with the AARP waving in support. Thank you. No other public testimony. Members, we are now in debate. Now in debate. Can't imagine what you have to debate. But, Ranking Member Joseph, you're recognized.
So I wanted to thank you both for bringing this bill forward. And I think it's timely and worth noting that this is the first day of Black History Month. So I look forward to supporting this bill. And as you noted, there were quite a few Haitian folks who participated with Haiti gaining its independence in 1801. It continued to fight for freedom throughout the Americas and actually throughout the world with some of the pilots participating in the program. A friend of mine, her grandfather, recently passed away last year, was one of these men. So I just wanted to thank you for the bill and to encourage all the members to vote up, although I can't imagine anybody voting down. So thank you.
Any other debate? Any other debate? Don't see in that? Representative Antone, or Representative Bankston, you're recognized to close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Antone. This is an honor to do this as a pilot and as someone who has loved and learned from history. I just want to close with this. Before Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier in baseball, before MLK Jr. had his dream, in the midst of an age where segregation still held captive, the mindset of American life was born the Tuskegee Airmen. This band of legendary aviators began as an experiment out of the necessity of World War II, but their acts of heroism, not only in fighting the enemy without, but facing the enemy within, proved the proposition that all men are created equal. Their character in the face of opposition seeded the dream that the standard measure of a person is truly not the color of their skin, but the conduct of their character. Their level of skill under fire in a complex environment of the cockpit where the whole man is tested, body, mind, and spirit, forever put to rest the divisive notion that we are separated internally by our color externally. Their skill, character, bravery, and excellence have handed us the tools we need to defeat those who still seek to divide us by class, color, or cultural difference. And their legacy is a torch passed to us to declare that we are one race, the human race, that we are all Americans together. And as the old song says, red and yellow, black and white, we're all precious in God's sight. Their dignity changed a mindset, and proved that our unique expressions can be woven together in an American fabric of humanity. So it is fitting and my honor to stand with you, my friend and colleague, and my brother, and ask that you support the act to establish a day to honor the lives of the heroic legacy of the Tuskegee Airmen.
Thank you for that excellent close. And with that, members, we're going to proceed to vote. Tamara, please call the vote.
Representatives Bankson?
Yes.
Brackett?
Yes.
Cross?
Yes.
Shock?
Yes.
Joseph?
Yes.
Lopez?
Yes.
Porras?
Yes.
Roth?
Yes.
Trunell?
Yes.
Waldron?
Yes.
Jarkowski? Roach? 10 yeas.
Thank you, members. By your vote, HB 1227 is reported favorably. Great job, sir. Thank you very much. Okay, with that, we're going to move around a little bit. We're waiting for some people to depart to room 404. They're not here yet, so we're going to go with HB 629 by Basabi and Plakin, Florida Women's Historical Marker Initiative.
Thank you, Chair. Good afternoon, everyone. Good afternoon, Chair, Ranking Chair, and fellow members. For far too long, many great women who have contributed to our state have gone unrecognized. I feel it's a symbolic time to create a bill to identify women statewide who have been instrumental and impactful to our state. Of 1,200 historical markers throughout Florida, including historical places, people, and events, only 20 are designated to women. This bill aims to rectify the absence of women in our state's history who are pivotal members of our society by dedicating 100 markers across the state to forever document as a tribute to their efforts. I stand proud to bring this bill before you, and I look forward to your favorable support.
Thank you, Representative, for that good explanation. Member, we're on to questions. Anybody have a question? You want me to go again?
What?
So, you know, when I think of a marker, I think of a magic marker. I'm not sure exactly what a marker is. Is it a post along the roadway that tells you that there's something to see here? What is a marker?
It's just going to be a plaque with a name in different areas throughout the state.
It's a plaque?
Not a plaque, a mile marker.
It is a mile marker. Okay, thank you.
It's not a mile marker.
Any other questions?
A bronze marker.
Okay. Okay, we don't have any amendments.
This is what they're going to look like. I just thought that this is what they're going to look like.
Ah, yes. Okay. Okay, so now we're on to public testimony. We have Barbara Devane with Florida Now, waving in support. We also have
Lynette Long.
Oh, Lynette Long, are you wishing to testify? Go ahead.
I am. I do. Thank you, Representative Roth and Ranking Member Joseph. These are the historical markers, what they look like. They're large, they're 42 inches across and 30 inches tall. Each one on a post that makes them like 6 feet tall. So this whole project started in 2017. It was a rainy Sunday afternoon. I'm a girl who's interested in women's issues, so I decided to count the markers in Florida, one by one, all online. Took a piece of paper, every time a marker, I put a slash mark, and every time a marker for a woman, I wrote her name. And at the end of my day, it was dark, there were 950 markers at that time, 2017, and six, as I said, six honored women. I looked at the six who honored women. I knew who Harriet Beecher Stowe was, who wintered in Florida, and I knew Zora Neale Hurston, but the rest of the women I didn't even know. And I consider myself fairly well educated. So I wrote an op-ed for the Tallahassee Democrat and said, we have 950 markers, only six women. It got people's attention, and the chair of the Division of Historical Resources for the state of Florida called me up. Lynette, this is terrible. I'm like, yeah? And he said, we have zero LGBTQ markers. I said, well, that's not my issue. I'm the women's marker girl. So I started applying, and nothing happened. Nothing happened. No markers more for women. So I said, well, I'll do it myself, one by one. And I applied for Julia Tuttle, who founded Miami, and gave half of her 640 acres to Henry Flagler to get him to bring the railroad here. What a story. She died broke. And she couldn't even vote when Miami was incorporated in 1895. I was sad. She didn't have the right to vote. Then I applied for Betty Mae Tiger Jumper, chief of the Seminole, only woman chief. She didn't have a marker. I applied for Amelia Earhart, who took off her last flight from Miami. I didn't even know that. She didn't have a marker. And in this pursuit, I discovered 100 women who were amazing. And they didn't have any recognition. They didn't have a marker that cost $2,300. For the other markers I put in, I found donors, the Hialeah Women's Club. So I put in half a dozen. I got the Everglades to put up Marjorie Stoneman Douglas. Everybody knows who she is. She saved the Everglades, but the Everglades Foundation wrote that. But the harder I worked, the further I got behind. And now there are 1,200 markers, and there are 17 women. So we went from 6 to 17, 8 of which I'm responsible for in that jump. So I said, we can't keep up, right? The state puts in 45 markers a year, average. So what I decided, I looked and looked, how could I fix this? And I noticed that New Mexico noticed in 2007, they had about 600 markers, and guess how many for women?
Six.
Zero. Zero. They weren't worse than us. It was the governor's wife who noticed, the first lady. And so they put in a program, and they put up 100 markers for women by now. And their program got nationwide acclaim, articles in every publication, not only in the state, in the whole country, because, wow, someone said something. You know, I'm so passionate about this issue, I could talk forever, but I won't. And here are a few women that I'm suggesting, but there are so many. Dr. Eugenie Clark from Sarasota. She is called the Shark Lady and the founder of the Moat Aquarium. An unbelievable person. Mary McLeod Bethune, everybody knows who she is. Florida just put her in the U.S. Capitol, and I have to tell you, I went to see that statue the last time I was here. I testified to put her and replace Edward Kirby Smith. And people, there was a line of African-American families lining up, I'm going to cry right now, with their kids, taking the picture with that statue. I was so proud to be from Florida, to be the first African-American statue in the collection. There are 100 statues of women, 100 statues in the collection, two per state. There are 11 women.
Can you wrap it up?
Yeah, and Charlotte County has women who played in the baseball, women's baseball, and during the war. Botanists who changed the Valencia orange, a woman, so that now it doesn't get viruses. There's so many. Ruth Alexander formed the Lady Gator program so women could play sports at the University of Florida. Can you imagine they couldn't play sports until the 70s? So anyway, so I would like to follow the New Mexico's lead here. We'd be the second state to do this with the marker program. And it is so amazing. You haven't gone to these unveilings. The whole community shows up. The Seminoles showed up for Betty Mae Tiger Jumper. There was a big luncheon. There's tents. And the 99 showed up for Amelia Earhart, the group she founded. It's an incredible thing. And as a woman and as a mother of a daughter and two granddaughters, it's so touching because you walk down the street, all the streets are named of men. The money is men. You're inundated. And this is something we could do to help everybody see that, yes, we have done something. So I hope you really support this bill.
Thank you for that. Public testimony, we're now in debate. Ranking Member Joseph, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to take a moment to acknowledge your efforts and thank you for all of the hard work that you have done, taking the initiative, the follow-through, the insistence. And I know the ones that you've already gotten there, people are so grateful for. So I thank you for all that you have done, all that you're continuing to do, and I want you to know that we see you, we appreciate you, and it matters.
I know it does matter. You know, I'm chair of the Miami Beach Commission for Women and Miami-Dade. I'm on their commission for women.
Hold on. So we're in debate. I'm going to make a comment. I think the day is going to come someday when we have a Lynette marker. How about that? So the good news is, I would dare say that most representatives and state senators may not have been history majors, but they are history majors after they graduate from the Florida legislature. It's quite a privilege to be a representative and learn all the things we learn. And with that, Representative Bisabi, you're recognized to close.
I'll keep it short and sweet because I brought the big guns and she kind of said it all for me. I just want to thank Dr. Lynette Long because we all, you know, file the bills, but this bill is yours. And I just thank you for allowing me to champion this with you. And bravo, and thank you, fellow members. I did explain it was a friendly bill, but we didn't need the whole package, but it was worth it because, and she could go on and on. So, and she'll be here all day.
Thank
you all for listening, and thank you for support.
And thank you, Representative, for that close. Tamara, call the vote.
Representatives Bankson?
Yes.
Brackett?
Yes.
Cross?
Yes.
Schock?
Yes.
Joseph?
Yes.
Lopez?
Yes.
Forrest?
Yes.
Roth?
Yes.
Trenell? Waldron?
Yes.
Yarkowski?
Yes.
Chair Roach?
Yes.
12 yeas, 0 nays.
Thank you, Tamara. By your vote, members, with HB 629 is reported favorably. And at this time, we see that Chair Roach has returned, and I transfer the gavel back to you. Thank you for not coming sooner. We just had a really fun marker bill, Chair.
All right. Thank you, Vice Chair Roth. Thank you for steering the ship here for a little bit. I see that it looks like we are on PCS for House Bill 1339. By Representative Black. I would have preferred you did that one before I got here, but I guess we are where we are. Good afternoon, Representative Black. Sir, you are recognized to explain PCS for House Bill 1339.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Ranking Member, members of the committee, Vice Chair. And members, this is quite possibly the most exciting bill you will hear all session. PCS for 1339 is an agency bill for the Department of Management Services, and it amends a limited set of sections of Florida statute that require the work of Department of Management Services to do a variety of things. The sections in this bill would include modifications to the aspects of the state personnel system to increase the state's ability to attract talent through the apprenticeship programs, addresses the Florida-based business preference to ensure that the benefit does in fact go to Florida-based businesses. It makes slight modifications to the qualifications for contract managers in the state, which will help these agencies fill necessary positions, among other slight changes. The bill further clarifies the classification of select exempt service and senior management service positions within state agencies. This expands the number of state employees that would be considered for these senior roles, which includes additional incentives to attract and retain the best to state government. The bill also creates an avenue for agencies to directly appoint those participating in approved apprenticeship programs to career service positions in an effort to continue to attract highly qualified individuals to state government.
BCS HB 1339 also expands upon the criteria for Florida-based businesses to qualify for a Florida-based business preference in a competitive state procurement. The bill also strengthens preference for Florida-based businesses who receive funds from the Florida Opportunity Fund and for U.S.-based businesses across the board relative to non-U.S. businesses. Following a 2020 federal review of the Florida State Agency for Surplus Property for the U.S. General Services Administration, this is where the exciting part comes in, folks, the bill codifies existing DMS budgetary practice in statute and ensures compliance with federal requirements on Florida's participation in the Federal Surplus Property Program. Finally, to continue supporting and strengthening the state workforce, the bill also changes the experience requirements for contract managers who must currently manage contracts in excess of $10 million, recognizing that the $5 million requirement is difficult to meet given the number of contracts in excess of this number, and comparing that against the need for contract managers, the bill modifies the requirement to require contract managers to manage contracts that are cumulatively in excess of $5 million. And members, that is the bill.
Okay, members, Rep. Black, having explained the first of two exciting bills that he has today, we're in questions. Vice Chair Roth, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Chair, and you didn't know this, but I've been having fun today while you were gone. I get to ask a lot of good questions. Chair Black, as a business owner, I think I understand the significance of a lot of these changes. But could you explain for us again why it helps us be able to hire more and better qualified people by having all these different categories and exemptions and classifications and moving people over into here and you know, some people would say discriminating. You're moving some people over here and some people over there and da-da-da-da-da. Can you give us how this really benefits the state of Florida and DMS?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative, for the question. So, that's actually maybe a number of questions. Let me see if I just can't come to 30,000 feet and state this. We spend a lot of money, the state of Florida does, on apprenticeship programs. And then we require people who have completed those apprenticeship programs to jump through all sorts of hoops and go through the ordinary processes in order to get a job with the state. And this allows them to skip that process. It reduces a lot of the bureaucracy and recognizes that we've spent money and we've spent it well, and we should now be trying to place these people into good positions. We need good public employees. The other thing that it does is it allows for a larger number of people to be classified as leadership, and they receive the benefits associated with that, and they are also employed at will. So that makes those leaders in our state government more responsive both to their superiors, but also ultimately to the people themselves. Thank you for the question.
Follow up one more.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, so what you're saying, just so we all understand, is that obviously management having more responsible positions and managing people and making policy decisions can be fired at will. That also implies that regular career service people cannot. Is that correct?
Thank you, Chair. So with greater rewards should come greater responsibility. And so you're absolutely right in that regard. And there was a second part to the question.
Second part was that a regular career service employees have a what I would call a protected process.
Thank you for the clarification.
You recognize, sir.
There's a more lengthy, some would say arduous, due process.
Thank you.
Members, we're in questions. No further questions. We're in public testimony. We do have a couple of cards here. We have Mr. Jake Holmgreen, Florida Department of Management Services, waves in support of the bill. We have Christopher Strandberg, Americans for Prosperity, waves in support of the bill. Members, that concludes public testimony. We're now in debate on PCS for House Bill 1339. Members, we're in debate. See no members that wish to debate. You are recognized to close on your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me just say that this bill, although a large bill, it will make government more responsive to the people, And it will also help ensure that preferences that we give to Florida companies are not, in fact, foreign companies incorporated here. I ask for your favorable support.
Having closed on his bill, Tamara, please call the roll and let's take a vote on PCS for House Bill 1339.
Representatives Bankson?
Yes.
Brackett?
Yes.
Cross?
Yes.
Schock?
Yes.
Joseph?
No.
Lopez?
Yes.
Porras? Roth?
Yes.
Treenow?
Yes.
Waldron?
Yes.
Yarkowski? Yes. Chair Roach?
Yes.
I'm actually a yes. Just kidding. Yep, got it in time.
There are 11 yeas, 0 nays.
Okay, members, let the record reflect that PCS for House Bill 1339 passes unanimously out of this committee with 11 yeas, 0 nays. Congratulations. And Rep. Black, don't go anywhere. This is actually the bill that I was hoping Vice Chair Roth would get through. House Bill 1471, you're recognized to explain your bill along with your prime co, if she's here, on public employees. You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. So House Bill 1471, titled Public Employees, it just builds on the progress that was made with the Paycheck Protection Act last year. It ensures protections for our workers while also allowing for labor organizations to better comply with financial transparency. The bill also provides exemptions from certain provisions for first responders. And members, that is the bill.
Okay, having explained the bill, members, we're in questions on House Bill 1471. I see Representative Cross has her hand up. You're recognized for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Black, I wanted to ask a couple questions related to Section 6, starting on line, I believe it's line 207, really looking at the membership authorization forms. The way I understand it, the state is now essentially authorized or requiring two membership forms, and we talk in a lot of our committees about reducing redundancy and government efficiency. Why does this bill require two membership forms that are essentially the same?
You're recognized.
Thank you for the question, Representative, and thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's counterintuitive, but what we find is that in the panoply of various public sector unions operating throughout the state, they are uneven in how they collect those forms and preserve those forms, and remembering they're accountable for that. They are actually audited for that. So because of the uneven collection of those forms and the absolute imperative that that data be collected and it be accurate under the statute, it is for that reason that they will also provide the form to PERC.
Yes, you're recognized for follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would a union be allowed to amend the PERC form to include other information that they would need to collect for an individual's membership, thereby reducing some of the paperwork?
You're recognized.
Thank you for the question. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There's nothing I'm aware of in Florida statute that would allow a union to modify rules of the state government. I do not believe they have that power.
Representative Cross, you're recognized for another question.
Thank you. And last question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you know of other instances where the state requires an individual to complete two forms that are essentially the same thing?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative, for the question. I'm not prepared to talk about particular areas where we're required to fill things out in duplicate, but I just recall that there was an entire industry that was built around duplicate forms. And so I am sure throughout government there are numerous instances, but I'm not prepared to discuss any individual ones today.
Ranking Member Joseph, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So at lines 207 to 220 of your bill, for some reason you tie the mandated form that Representative Cross was just inquiring about to the 60% membership threshold. Was that intentional?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative. Yes.
Follow up?
You're recognized.
Why?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative. Calculating the forms is one way that they establish reaching the 60% threshold.
Follow up?
Recognize.
Wouldn't them paying the membership also be reflective of the intent that's requisite to meet the 60% membership threshold?
Recognize.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative. Yes.
Follow up?
You recognize for follow up.
So why, I mean, if they're paying the dues, why do we need to tie the form to the membership threshold requirement from the prior bill we had?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative. We need to know who they are. We need to know when they joined. We also need to know if they dropped out of the union, and we need to collect that data so that we can tie it to the 60% threshold. That becomes an auditable matter, and it's been difficult to gather that information coherently across all of the unions. Now, many do a good job, but this will help allow us to ensure that we have the correct data and that everyone is treated fairly, no matter what union leadership you have in what part of the state.
You recognize your follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that's interesting. Maybe you don't know this, but there was litigation about that specific issue. And in that litigation, PERC represented to the court that the forms would not be mandated, and instead it was optional, so that, and when I say optional for the purpose of reaching the 60% threshold. So with the 60% threshold, they represented to the court that just paying the dues was reflective of that requisite intent. So I don't know if you were aware of that when you formulated that language in the bill, but now, assuming that that is correct, which I'm sure you can confirm, if PERC is telling the court that that doesn't count, the forms are not required to meet the 60% threshold, wouldn't it make sense to amend your bill to revise that to comport with what PERC represented to the court?
You're recognized, sir.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative, for the question. This means to make the bill that we passed previously better and make it possible for them to conduct their duties in a way that will be transparent and compliant with that legislation. This is doing exactly what we need it to do. And going forward, they'll be able to answer that question differently because it will be consistent with the new law.
Vice Chair Roth, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Black, for your bill today and for trying to improve the bill that you passed last year. I do have a funny question. We're talking about a lot of things that the employees are required to do, teachers are required to do. Would you be willing to consider an amendment to this bill that would allow teachers the option to do their own payroll deduction through their checking account rather and also allow them to be able to do a payroll deduction if they choose that option? Would you be willing to make that kind of amendment?
You're recognized, sir.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you, Representative, for the question. The Florida Constitution guarantees individuals the right to collectively bargain, to participate in a union, or not. I do not believe that the state government needs to interpose itself in the free exercise of that right.
Follow-up?
You're recognized for follow-up.
So have you had any input in the last 6 months or so as to the impact of not being able to do a payroll deduction?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Chairman. Everyone seems to be able to comply with this, just as we envisioned when we passed it last year. There are all sorts of ways for people to effectively pay their dues without having the state of Florida, without having the government itself do it for you.
Okay, we're in questions. We're going to go back to Ranking Member Joseph. We're going to go over to Rep. Lopez back there. Rep. Lopez, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, Rep. Black. I just have two questions. The first one is, do you think that this bill negatively impacts the membership of the unions?
You are recognized to respond.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative. No.
Hey. Thank you, and thank you for the good questions. Members of the audience, I know there's a lot of passion here, but I'd ask you just to keep it down just a little bit while we're in Q&A here.
I have another.
Oh, I'm sorry. Rep. Lopez, recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The second and last question, did you have any conversations with union presidents to amend the bill or improve the bill?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative, for the question. I have spoken to several union representatives, and I have asked them to supply specific information as to what they might oppose and specific legislative remedies if they believe that they can envision some. But I've also had people come to my office and express that they are very grateful, and these are public employees, and they have expressed their gratitude for the bill that we passed last year and for this bill, which is helping to refine its implementation. And I'll just give you one example. In my hometown, in Duval County, there was a raid where the teachers' union was raided by the FBI and IRS for alleged financial improprieties. Now, we'll have to await the results of the investigation, but one of the things that we did and that we knew was so important is we wanted our workers to have financial transparency. If you want to join a union, join a union. If you don't, you shouldn't have to. But if you do, you ought to know what's happening with your money. And this bill today helps to refine the bill that we passed before, and it helps to protect our workers. We should be proud of that, and we should be pleased today to vote up on this bill, because voting up on this bill is a vote for transparency and integrity and protects our public employees.
Rep. Lopez?
Thank you. Thank you. That would be all.
Okay, we're going to go over to Rep. Waldron. He's been waiting patiently for a question. Representative Waldron, you're recognized.
Thank you very much, Chair. My question is, do you know of any unions that have not been recertified despite meeting the new requirements, the new threshold in last session's bill?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Representative Waldron. Thank you, Chair. I know of a union in Miami that failed to meet the 60% threshold, and I am not sure of their exact status at the moment, but I believe that they have likely petitioned for recertification and will be subject to an election, and that's going to give the workers there a choice, which is a good thing, and points up the value of us having passed this bill in the first place. And what's happening is you're getting transparency, and workers are getting real choices.
Representative Waldron, recognized for a follow-up.
Has PERC reported an increase in workload due to this passage?
You're recognized. The bill?
Thank you, Representative, for the question. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. They haven't reported it to me, but since we're implementing a new law, there would have to be additional work associated with that, I would think, surely.
We're going to go back to Ranking Member Joseph. You're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With respect to the unions that were previously exempted from the prior legislation, specifically police and fire, it's my understanding that your bill now requires that a majority, I'm using that specific language from your bill, have to be a part of the union a majority of them have to be police and firemen before it will apply. But they also have other people who work within their unions who may not be sworn law enforcement officers or actual firemen. Is there a reason why you're selecting a majority, whereas, you know, it might be 49%? So you're saying that that exemption wouldn't apply to them either?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative, for the question. So I think I understand your question. So we have some people who, frankly, should have been included as public safety in the original bill. And so to that extent, this is sort of a glitch bill, goes back and puts them where they rightly ought to have been all along. And it further defines what a category of employee is and provides an objective way to analyze it and decide whether they fall into that category or not. And 50% was the number. Thank you for the question.
Recognize your follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So based on your response, I understand that, like, if a union only got to 49% that was law enforcement, which is still a significant amount, but because of just that 1% difference, they would not qualify for the exemption, notwithstanding the significant proportion of police and firemen that are part of that particular union.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative, for the question. So I'm not aware of any bargaining unit where you have 49% sworn law enforcement and 51% some other thing. I don't think that actually exists. But just as a hypothetical, what we had were certain bargaining units where we had a tiny, tiny fraction, maybe 1% less even, of sworn law enforcement in a bargaining unit. And upon that basis, they claimed that the entire organization was public safety. That was not true. This bill corrects that. We have to have an objective standard, and that's where the standard is established in this bill.
Okay, one more.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So going back to the mandated form, you articulated a couple of items that you think are needed for whatever administrative reason, separate from a clear intent of the person by paying their dues to participate in the union that you think need to be included for the 60% membership threshold. My question for you is, if they're paying their dues and they have a union form that has all of the information that you deem appropriate, why not just use that? It's the same information. It doesn't tie it to a form, and it rather ties it to the actual paying of the dues, which obviously manifests clear intent to participate in the union.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative, for the question. I'm really grateful that you brought that up. As I've said, I've had numerous constituents come to my office thanking us for the bill and asking for further assistance. And one of the things that we have found, and I'm not sure how pervasive this is, but in at least one union, they're asking for forms to be filled out in triplicate, and they have three of them. And it becomes a very convoluted process. It's very hard to track. And we need to make sure that there's transparency and integrity in this process. It's not that hard, and PERC needs to get the data directly, and that way we will know they're complying with the law, and our workers will be protected.
Okay, members, that concludes questions. We're going to move into public testimony on the bill. Dr. Templin, are you here? It says here on this form that you are waving in support, but I doubt that very seriously. So you're recognized to come to the podium and state your position, sir. Good afternoon.
I apologize for checking support. But that is an aspirational goal of mine. with this legislation, and I mean that sincerely. If folks haven't been paying attention, here's what's been going on for the last 7-8 months. Senate Bill 256 passed. The automatic paycheck deduction for union dues, all the other paycheck deductions are still there, but the ones for union dues are gone. The 60% threshold is there. That is the law of the land. We understand that. We accept it. It is what it is. The problem is that we have had an incredibly difficult time complying with the law. We want to comply, but it's been very difficult. The PERC rulemaking process, I've been to every single PERC hearing as we've gone through this, months of discussions, has had a terribly difficult time. It's not PERC's problem. It was based on how the bill was worded. This legislation fixes some of what has been identified in that process, but it doesn't fix everything. And we are here to help. Look. The unions, we just want to serve our members. We just want to serve each other. And I will silently, with your indulgence, if you're a union worker in the room, please hold up your hand. Now, nobody's turning in cards. Nobody's yelling and screaming because we are here to help. We want to help implement this. And there is nobody in this room who understands this process better than we do. Not the Freedom Foundation. Not the James Madison Institute, right? We understand how to do it. We want to help you. We have provided three amendments to the bill sponsor with a rationale for those amendments. We are doing the same work in the House. We're trying to work collaboratively. And so that's all we're asking. We're asking for an opportunity through our experiences with PERC, with everything that has happened, to get this right so that we can comply with the law. Right now, we can't. PERC's having a heck of a time coming up with rules. We've got unions out there that are waiting for their elections to happen, that have cleared every hurdle. But we're having a hard time moving forward. So we oppose the bill as of now because it just doesn't go far enough. And it was a mistake that I checked that form, but it's kind of opportune because that's where we want to get. We want to get to that place where we can support it, not only for our members, but for PERC, for the taxpayers, for everyone. So thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, as always.
Thank you, Dr. Templin. As always, eloquent and passionate. Thank you, sir. Next up, we have Mr. Jeff Sharkey, representing the Florida Nurses Association, wants to present. Okay. So he's waiving his time. Your form says info only. Do you want to express your support or opposition to the bill? Okay. Thank you, sir. Okay. Next up, we have Mr. George Chamizo, representing the Center for Worker Progress Action Incorporated, waiving in support of the bill. We have Mr. Chris Strandberg, Americans for Prosperity, waving in support of the bill. Stephanie Kunkel, Florida Education Association, waving in support of the bill. Okay. You are recognized to oppose or support the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did you really? Is my box is literally checked as opposition? But
Well, so the box is checked as an opponent, but then the wave and support box is highlighted. So I'm not sure. Yeah, but you're recognized. Clarify your piece, please.
Thank you, Chair Roach. Stephanie Kunkel, on behalf of the Florida Education Association and our more than 100,000 members in the state of Florida. As Dr. Templin mentioned, we have been working with the sponsor in both the House and the Senate. We are not asking to relitigate Senate Bill 256. We are simply here asking for corrections. And so we do appreciate the few provisions that are in the bill. Again, as Rich stated, they don't go far enough. I want to highlight just one provision. And I think you guys were touching a little bit on the membership form. Right now, as it stands, unions are being required essentially to do two membership forms. One membership form that our unions have been using for nearly 50 years, which include a lot of information that is not found on the PERC form. Unfortunately, the PERC form does not go far enough to collect as much information as we would need in order to have our members be represented. And so therefore, they would then be obligated under this new law to fill out the PERC membership form in order to reach that 60%. So we do believe that that is duplicative. And so we are asking for you to get rid of the PERC mandated form. We provide enough information, which is provided to PERC in every one of our renewals of registration and our recertification process. So again, not to belabor the point, we are working with the sponsor. At this point, we cannot support the legislation, but we hope to get to a place where we can in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. Okay, members, that concludes public testimony. We are now in debate on House Bill 1471 by Representative Black. Members in debate, anyone wishing to debate? Rep. Waldron, you are up first. You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to address something that you mentioned. I personally have not had any union members come to my office expressing support for SB 256. And not just in my office, but I'm out in public meeting a lot of people. So I've never had anybody come up and say that to me. But yet you say that you're having a lot of people show up at your office. So I would invite you to just maybe give me a call next time so I can come down and meet those people. And also, I just want to say that last year I voted down on SB 256, and this to me is just creating a duplicative process. I just think that it seems to be an attack on unions, and it, as I said last time, it was a poor solution in search of a problem that has never existed. So I just wanted to reiterate that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Rep. Waldron. We're going to go back to Rep. Lopez. Gotcha this time. You're recognized in debate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I strongly believe in the unions. As a former teacher, I couldn't imagine my life in the school system without the union. The union support, educate, and represent the workers and always make sure that their members follow the law, do their jobs, but being respected because they also have rights. I hope you amend the bill. I think that small changes will be highly appreciated. Today, I'll be down, but looking forward to working together and then vote if, you know, up if you make the changes. Thank you.
Okay, this is our last committee meeting, and I had to encourage Rep. Ranking Member Joseph, but she is going to join us in debate here. Ranking Member, you're recognized in debate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I feel for the unions that are impacted, and all of them are impacted in this particular bill, because they're trying to do what you ask them to do. They're trying to comply. And I know that some senators last go around had tried to articulate some of the concerns with the bill that would make it a challenge to implement. And really, I'm just hoping that you take some of it to heart, because you know people aren't fighting. Like, whatever battles were won and lost have already been dealt with. Like, we're here now, and they're trying to do what you ask. And I think there are a number of issues that have been identified that can be worked on. And I just hope that you and the Senate bill sponsor will heed and hear some of those very reasonable requests so that they can do what you're asking them to do, so that they can exercise the constitutional right to collective bargaining that you articulated earlier.
We have concluded debate. With that, you're recognized to close on your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members, for your heartfelt conversation. I mean to continue to have a dialogue. I envisioned this process overall to ultimately be helpful to not just our workers, but to the very unions themselves. Being accountable for the people you serve should not be regarded as something that you have to do. It should be regarded as something that you get to do. And I find in business that when we recommit ourselves to customer service, we find in the end that we are better at our job, that it is more rewarding. And that's what this bill has taken us down a path toward. I regret that it is even necessary, though, that we pass any such legislation. If every union were doing a perfect job, we wouldn't even be having this conversation today. But they are not. If we would like to have fewer such conversations, I admonish those who are failing to live up to the standards of transparency and integrity and decency toward our employees to please keep the IRS and the FBI out of your offices. Please make sure that I don't have employees coming and complaining that they're being coerced, because that's what I hear from admittedly a small minority of our unions, and we have many of them that are very good. But I will not stand here and pretend that this legislation wasn't necessary last year, nor that the correctives in it today aren't necessary today. I am here to stand for transparency and integrity and with our workers. And I will not be told that we are not helpful to the unions and not listening to their feedback. I want to help them do their job. To that end, we have made it easier for them to be able to comply with the audit provisions by using any ordinary CPA rather than one that is an auditor. So we have been listening, but we are adamant. There will be transparency. There will be integrity. The rights of our workers will be respected. Thank you, members of the committee, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you, Representative Black. Having closed on his bill, Tamara, please call the roll and let's take a vote on House Bill 1471.
Representatives Bankson?
Yes.
Brackett?
Yes.
Cross?
No.
Schock?
Yes.
Joseph?
No.
Lopez?
No.
Porras?
Yes.
Roth?
Yes.
Trunell?
Yes.
Waldron?
No.
Jorkowski? Chair Roach?
Yes.
8 yeas, 4 nays.
Okay, members, by your vote, let the record reflect that House Bill 1471 passes favorably out of this committee by a vote of 8 yeas and 4 nays. Thank you, Representative Black. Congratulations. Have a great day.
Thank you, members. Thank you, Chair.
Members, if I could ask you to stay here for just 1 minute. I know you all have places to go. This concludes our final meeting for the 2022-2024 term. It's been an honor to serve with all of you. I would like to give you some stats here. During this time, we have had a total of 96 bills referred to this committee. We have 69 of those were first references. We've heard 48 and passed 48 bills out of this committee. I'd like to open up the floor if anyone has any parting shots in our last meeting here. Okay, ranking member has some words.
Thank you. As the members of the public start to depart, I just wanted to take a moment to thank you. Thank you for your presence. Thank you for your attempted participation. Thank you for engaging in our government. Thank you for caring. Thank you for the work that you do day in and day out. I just really wanted to say thank you. We're doing our best to help support all that you do at all levels of government. And I think that sentiment is actually bipartisan. How we go about it may be different, but I want you to know that we see you, we hear you, and you're important.
I'd like a follow-up with that.
Okay, Vice Chair Roth, you're recognized.
I'll just say very simply, the world is run by people who show up. This process does not work if you do not hold us accountable. Please, as I tell my wife, when she says you're not listening, I tell her I am listening, I just don't always agree. We do hear you. Thank you for showing up. Numbers do matter. Tell your friends.
Other members in the committee wish to say something. Representative Cross, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd also like to thank the union members for coming today and for showing solidarity on this issue. And thank you, Chair Roach, for allowing us to have robust debate and questioning here and allowing for public comments. I think that you've done an admirable job of providing all of us an opportunity to share our voices.
Thank you, Representative Cross. Other members wish to make a parting comment here. I will say just a couple of things. First, I want to thank Speaker Renner for the opportunity to chair this committee. This is the first time I've chaired a committee. It's been an honor to do this. And to the members that have served on this committee, just looking at the name of this committee, Constitutional Rights, Rule of Law, and Government Operations, I mean, that's some very heavy work. I'm very proud of all of you who have served this. Ranking Member Joseph and members of the opposition party have helped make some of these bills better. You've planted a lot of seeds in all of the controversial bills that we've heard. I mean, we had some big ones. We had the union bill, paycheck protection. We had constitutional carry last year. The debate has been passionate, but it's been civil, and the debate on both sides has been a credit to this institution, I feel. So I want to thank you all for your passion and your professionalism. And I want to say one word about our staff. As a first-time chairman, I've had the opportunity to really learn what they do. They're here before the sun comes up. They're here after the sun goes down. I've leaned on my policy chief, Eric Miller, and particularly on our staff director, Heather Williamson, greatly, as well as the rest of the staff, and I may forget a few, but Roberta, Shannon, Lance, Jonathan, Tamara, Lexi, Chris, and if I've missed anyone, I apologize, but Jason. He's sitting right back there, and I forgot. Left them off the list. But I want to thank you all for your diligence and your attention to detail and making all of us look great. So thank you. With that, Representative Cross moves that we rise. This final meeting is adjourned. See you on the floor.